It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Mark Lippert, was attacked and wounded Thursday in Seoul. Local media reports said Lippert was taken to a hospital bleeding from a facial wound. A news agency is saying a man only identified by the name Kim was arrested after the attack. It said the man screamed, "South and North Korea should be reunified," during the attack. Russian President Vladimir Putin today called the murder of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov a disgrace to his country. Mr. Putin called on law enforcement agencies to focus on high-profile crimes, including those that are politically motivated. Russia's Interfax news agency quotes the director of the country's main security agency as saying suspects have been identified in the case. A top official says the U.S. government is considering imposing new sanctions on Russia if a Ukraine ceasefire continues to be violated. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, has sent a team to Europe to coordinate the measures with allied governments. The president of Chad says his forces know the location of Abubakar Shekau. He's the leader of the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. President Idriss Deby is calling on the rebel leader to surrender or be killed. Mr. Deby spoke Wednesday in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, during a joint news conference with the visiting president of Niger. Secretary of State John Kerry says negotiators in the Iran nuclear talks have made some progress, but in his words, there are still significant gaps and important choices that need to be made. He made the remarks after wrapping up 3 days of talks with Iran's foreign minister in Switzerland. This is VOA News. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says dozens of fighters have been killed in an attack on an intelligence facility in the city of Aleppo. The dead include both Syrian security personnel and rebels. The attack began when a bomb went off near the Air Force intelligence building. The U.S. Justice Department concluded Wednesday that the police department in the Midwestern U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, routinely violated the constitutional rights of its black citizens. The department accused Ferguson police of using excessive force against black people and often making arrests without probable cause. The report is the result of a 6-month investigation launched after last year's shooting death of a black shoplifting suspect by a white police officer. Even with their conclusions about Ferguson police, federal officials say they will not bring civil rights charges against the officer who shot a black suspect. The defense lawyer for suspected Boston Marathon bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev told the jury at his trial Wednesday that Tsarnaev did indeed help carry out the 2013 attack. But attorney Judy Clark said Tsarnaev's older brother was actually the mastermind behind the attack. Clark is one of America's foremost death penalty specialists. By blaming the older brother, Clark is hoping to convince the jury to not sentence the 21-year-old Jokhar to death. Tsarnaev stared straight ahead, avoiding looking at the jury, as the prosecutor described the crime and blamed him for it. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday in a challenge to President Barack Obama's health care law called Obamacare. If the challenge is successful, it could lead to changes in the law that would affect Americans who depend on government subsidies to help them buy health insurance. Pointing to the wording of the law, opponents of Obamacare say the statute allows subsidies to be given only to people who buy insurance in marketplaces established by states, not the federal government. If a majority of the high court accepts that standard, an estimated 8 million people could lose their health insurance. Libya has asked the UN Security Council to ease or lift an arms embargo to allow it to meet the growing threat from Islamic militants. Libya is reportedly asking for tanks, fighter jets, attack helicopters, and rifles. Two Australian drug smugglers in Indonesia were taken from their Bali prison Wednesday to an island where they are to be executed. Besides the two Australians, Andrew Chan and Murian Sukumaran, a Nigerian national also was transferred to the island prison. The two Australians were dubbed the leaders of the so-called Bali Nine group. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Lesotho's opposition to form the country's next government, having acquired the majority in parliament.
The electorate of Lesotho have decided to put their own fate. Is that they gave quite a difficult outcome. Small parties have joined DC and LCD to form government.
Celeb Maseri Bani is Lesotho's Minister of Gender, Youth, Sports and Recreation. A Zambian opposition spokesman says President Edgar Lungu appears to have a phobia of UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema. A Kenyan court has charged 7 former officials with involvement in a multi-million dollar corruption scam. And another deadline may have come and passed for South Sudan's warring parties to reach a peace deal.
It is these two leaders. They may not be the alone, but they must be the leaders and lead towards peace. Leading a war is easy, but to be a peace hero is very difficult.
Ambassador Seyoum Mesfim is the lead mediator for the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD. The United Nations begins a month-long session this week on human rights in the Gambia. And African Americans will this Saturday commemorate the 50th anniversary of the fight for voting rights. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A senior official of Lesotho's coalition government says Prime Minister Thomas Thabane is expected to resign within the next 14 days to pave way for the formation of a new administration. Gender and Youth, Sports and Recreation Minister Tesele Maseri Bani tells reporter Peter Clotty that Mr. Thabane's government will now be in the opposition after former Prime Minister Pakalita Masisile led his Democratic Congress Party to form a coalition with other parties after the February 28th election.
Well, we just come from elections, and the figures that the electorate of Lesotho have decided to put their own fate is that they gave quite a difficult outcome. Small parties have joined DC and LCD to form government. And they have reached a number of 65. Me and BNP and ABC and RCL, which is a breakaway from LCD, we have only 55 in our coalition. So this is the current situation as we are talking now. They have declared themselves as majority in parliament, and we are in opposition.
So basically, within 2 weeks, the prime minister would have to resign because constitutionally he's supposed to, a new government is supposed to take effect after the
final. Inside 14 days.
There was a problem when there were sharp disagreements within the coalition government of Prime Minister Tom Thabane that was blamed on the attempted coup. Would you advocate for amendment in the constitution to ensure that this problem doesn't exist again about the formation of a coalition government?
Yeah, well, I think the way that we have seen in 2012, how the electorate come around after elections, it's still the same way. So we are bound to live with coalitions in Lesotho. Even to go even further, we can even call it government of national unity can appear in Lesotho. It was very close to it before trading off began. I think there was some time when the figures were showing 60-60. That means we could easily say, now we are at loggerhead. They just tell me it. But to say, yes, I'll support that, those kind of reforms to be there for the sake of the country, for the country to be stable when there's a coalition.
What is the current security situation in the country? Because we know tension was supposedly high ahead of the election. Now that the election has ended, people appear to have settled to the outcome of the election. What is the current situation of security in the country?
It's not. There's still some emotions to those who have lost. Our followers are still emotionally disillusioned. The issue of the commander, it's very unfortunate that the leader of LCD, who's supposed to be the deputy prime minister, was already talking about reinstating of the commander, the dismissed commander of LDF. And that really will lead to an instability. So we are not quite sure how the new government is going to handle those kind of issues.
Fasile Masiribane is Lesotho's Gender, Youth, Sports and Recreation Minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Maseru. The deputy spokesman of Zambia's opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says President Edgar Lungu appears to have a phobia of UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema because of the narrow margin with which Mr. Lungu won Zambia's January 20th special election over Mr. Hichilema. Deputy UPN spokesman Cornelius Mwitwa says, in his opinion, Lungu is a very insecure president because he did not expect Mr. Hichilema to have such a big showing in the last election. This comes after Zambian police on Wednesday summoned and questioned Mr. Hichilema for allegedly claiming that he, Hichilema, receives intelligence reports before they reach President Lungu. UPND deputy spokesman Mwitwa says Mr. Hichilema chose to remain silent when questioned by the police.
We basically questioned him for the same statement in respect of a newspaper article which attributed a statement that he had said that he receives intelligence reports before the head of state, you know, does. Then they also questioned him about a statement which I think is attributed to him, where he's saying that the head of state has sent people to South Africa to go and find out if Hichilema has funding for the just-ended presidential elections. Basically about two or three charges which are not properly, you know, founded.
President Lungu has said that Mr. Hichilema has claimed that he is controlling the state security in Zambia. Mr. Hichilema, did he say that or he did not say it?
Well, at the moment, I cannot say, because when he appeared before the police investigators and in one and caution statement, he opted to remain silent, and that the whole investigation is based on newspaper articles that are attributed to him. Now, the fact that he opted to remain silent means that I'm not in a position to say whether or not he actually said or made those statements. But what has to be, I think, understood is that the statements as attributed to him in the newspaper are different in context to what he actually stated at the briefing.
Is there anything to what is going on in Zambia, particularly after the last election, that we don't know about?
Well, I don't think there's really much that is going on, except that the current head of state, in my own opinion, I think that he is a very insecure president, knowing that he won the election by just about or around 1% of the vote, which is highly questionable.
The president has said also that this is not the time for politicking. Elections are over. And so is Mr. Hichilema ready to help the president, as he said, to rebuild the country or come together as a country to develop the country?
Well, stating something is one thing and doing it is another. It is actually the head of state who at every opportunity he has had to make commentaries on issues of national importance. He has not shown that, you know, magnanimity to be able to project posture that is uniting and one that won't bring, you know, the country together. Each time he has an opportunity to talk, the only things he has been talking about are those of trying to denounce the opposition, always indicating that he is not comfortable either with the opposition or with some dissident elements within his political party.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the deputy spokesman of Zambia's opposition UPND party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America, and the time is now 14 minutes past the hour. A Kenyan court on Wednesday charged seven former government officials, including a former finance minister, with involvement in a multi-million dollar corruption scam known as the Anglo-Leasing scandal. It came about when a British firm was hired at inflated cost to provide a new passport printing system at a cost of nearly $1 billion. Manua Isipisu is spokesman for President Uhuru Kenyatta. He says the charges prove President Kenyatta is committed to the rule of law and justice.
I think the Director of Public Prosecutions has ordered the prosecutions on the basis that he believes he has some evidence that could lead to a conviction. That's the basis on which prosecutors bring charges to court normally. It's former finance minister, former principal secretaries, former senior government officers, and three private businessmen that the Director of Public Prosecutions believes he has got a case against. Mainly in terms of the business people, it was receiving money on false pretenses, going into the millions of dollars. The government officers was authorizing fraudulently payments that should never have been authorized in the first place. I think this case has dragged on for nearly 10 years. Many Kenyans believed it was almost lost, but President Uhuru Kenyatta ordered the Anti-Corruption Authority to begin a fresh investigation, and I think we are where we believe that we can put this matter to rest.
As you mentioned, this case has dragged on. How much money are we talking about?
It's at least $1 billion.
What does this prove? Does this mean that President Kenyatta is serious now to fighting corruption?
I don't think it's a question of serious now. President Kenyatta won elections nearly 2 years ago, partly on the grounds that he was a man that Kenyans believed would deal with the issues at hand, including corruption. So he is a president that is committed to the rule of law, he's committed to justice, he's committed to good governance, and he's doing everything that pretty much ensures that he keeps to his word.
Is it true that the person who replaced Mr. Obure as finance minister might have also been implicated in this scandal?
Well, former finance minister David Miraria was charged. He wasn't in court because of illness. He's due to appear in court on March 18, and I think we'll take the case from there once he appears in court.
Who else might have known about this? I mean, who is the court dragging in this besides these officials? Because this case, as you mentioned, goes all the way back to the administration of President Mwai Kibaki. And who else is most likely to come into this?
I think we can speculate on who is likely to come into this. We know that there are 13 officials, or former officials in previous administrations. There is a sitting senator in the current administration, and there are business people. There are a total of 13 people, and this case is going ahead as we speak. We can't speculate on who else might be brought in.
Manua Isipisu is the spokesman for President Uhuru Kenyatta. He was speaking with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. It appears another deadline may have come and passed for South Sudan's warring parties to reach a peace deal. President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar on Wednesday suspended face-to-face talks in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, that were supposed to help them overcome disagreements and reach a deal. Lucy Pony has this report.
Rebel spokesman Puat Kang Chol says the face-to-face talks stalled of a laundry list of disagreements.
They rejected the security arrangement by saying, you just come back and you will be reintegrated. They rejected the report of the African Commission report of inquiry. They rejected it. They rejected the formula of world sharing, saying there is no need to share that and the world should be concentrated at the national level. They rejected the issue of the debt because we requested them to declare their debt, because our belief is that once we form the government of national unity, it's a government that will belong to all of us. It will be our government and we will all be obliged to pay the debt. They also went as far as saying we reject the reconstitution of the government by even defining the government to mean the executive only.
On that last point, Port says the opposition led by Machar wants all three pillars of the government, the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature, to be reconstituted based on power-sharing ratios agreed to at the talks in Addis Ababa. Ambassador Seyoum Mesfin has been the lead mediator for Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, at the South Sudan talks for more than a year. He says that after months of broken promises and breached ceasefire agreements, IGAD is almost running out of patience.
It is frustrating. Here are the leaders, the two leaders. If I thought there are two individuals in South Sudan who should be asked to be of courage and determination and political will to end this crisis, it is these two leaders. They may not be the alone, but they must be the leaders and lead towards peace. Leading a war is easy, but to be a peace hero is very difficult.
IGAD has given Mr. Kiir and Machar until midnight to reach a peace deal. Seyoum has called this round of talks South Sudan's last chance for peace. But he says IGAD will not throw in the towel on South Sudan, even if Kiir and Machar cannot reach a deal. Michael Makwe, the spokesman for the government of South Sudan, says the talks have not completely broken down and neither should people's hopes for peace.
I cannot up to now say that the talks have collapsed. We are still optimistic and there is high hope for peace to come to South Sudan.
The big question is, will the much-desired peace come by the deadline set by IGAD? And if it does not, what does the future hold for South Sudan? For VOA, I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
The United Nations Human Rights Council begins a month-long session this week, and a recent report alleging torture in a Gambian prison will be on the agenda. Sabrina Matani, West Africa researcher at Amnesty International, tells Ricky Shryak that the upcoming UN attention to Gambia could give other nations an opportunity to pressure Gambia into addressing human rights issues in the country.
These are two really key moments, I think, for the international community to really look at the sort of deteriorating situation of human rights in Gambia and to try and put some pressure and a spotlight, really, on them. In terms of the special rapporteur, this is quite monumental because it was the first time he ever went to Gambia and the first time, I think, that Gambia has engaged with these mechanisms that the UN has, such as, you know, the special rapporteurs. But it was also the first time in the history of the special rapporteur's mandate that he was refused unfettered access to detention facilities. So he was not able to go and look at Mile 2, which is a prison where differing inmates and political prisoners are known to be held. So I think that is really a sign of Gambia's unwillingness to cooperate with international human rights mechanisms and something that really should be highlighted.
In all practicality, what kind of power does the UN have over the human rights situation in Gambia, given Yahya Jammeh's kind of history?
Obviously, it's a very difficult situation in Gambia, given the fact that, you know, Yahya Jammeh seems to have kind of disrespect for kind of the views of the international community and is sort of further isolating himself. However, I do think we've made some strides in the last few years. The spotlight is really now on Gambia, and people are starting to take a lot more interest and care into the deteriorating human rights situation there. And I think that the UPR and the Human Rights Council is a prime opportunity for many states, including many states in the region, to continue to lobby Gambia and to press Gambia to adopt some of the recommendations.
In the statement released by Amnesty, you mentioned torture. Could you talk a little bit about what you know about the torture and how you know about this information about presumed torture possibly going on in the prison?
So the special rapporteur stated that there is a prevalence of torture in the Gambia, and he interviewed many people, and he says in his report that he found the testimonies truthful and consistent with other testimonies regarding practices and methods used and substantiates this physical evidence.
Sabrina Matani is a West Africa researcher at Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. U.S. President Barack Obama and thousands of people will gather in Selma, Alabama on Saturday, March 7th to commemorate the 50th anniversary of a historic voting rights march that became known as Bloody Sunday. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports.
Hundreds of peaceful African-American demonstrators marched for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago.
As the civil rights demonstrators made their way across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were met on the other side by a group of state police officers who attacked them.
The violent images outraged the nation, drawing national attention to the denial of voting rights for millions of African Americans.
I had to go to the courthouse, stand in line, and vote.
50 years later, civil rights activist Nims Gay returned to the Birmingham courthouse, where he and other blacks questioned white county officials who rejected their constitutional right to vote.
What you're really trying to do is intimidate these people, and by making them stand in the rain, keep them from registering to vote.
Why do you think you're superior to me? Don't you realize from one blood all nations flow? Or is that something you don't understand? And see, that irritates them. Don't let them worry about nobody. Irritate nobody. When you're right, you're right. And when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Following legal challenges, blacks were allowed to vote. He says the fight was hard but worth it.
A voteless people is a hopeless people. Don't care whether you're black, white, green, or gray. If you can't vote, you're messing up.
Retired teacher Gene Smiley was among the first blacks allowed to vote in Montgomery, Alabama.
A lot of people around in Montgomery and surrounding areas out. So many of them were really afraid to go and try to vote.
Days after Bloody Sunday, Hank Sanders marched with Martin Luther King and thousands to Alabama's capital, Montgomery. Civil rights lawyer Fred Gray, who represented King, won a court ruling to allow the successful march from Selma to Montgomery. Back in Birmingham, Nims Gay sings the civil rights anthem that inspired him and so many others in this struggle for equality.
The Lord is on our side today. Deep in my heart.
Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Birmingham, Alabama. Hundreds of peaceful African-American demonstrators marched for voting rights in Selma, Alabama 50 years ago.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Hundreds of peaceful African-American demonstrators marched.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Commonwealth Games women's long jump champion Brume Ese and World Junior Men's 200-meter silver medalist Divine Oduduru lead the Nigerian charge for gold medals at the Africa Junior Athletics Championships starting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, today, Thursday. Nigeria are African champions, having topped the medal table 2 years ago in Mauritius. Meanwhile, South Africa's 2022 Durban Commonwealth Games Bid Committee Chairman Mark Alexander says hosting the Games fits in well with the country's national development plan. Alexander reckons their bid was well received.
We presented our bid in the formal process in London on Monday. It was very well received. There were several ambassadors from the Commonwealth countries who really praised the bid we had. On Tuesday, we met with the CGF and we had a formal meeting with them. Again, the president came out quite strong in support and the quality of our bid. The CGF is working with our government, working with us, and to make sure that we can deliver the first African Commonwealth Games.
Although a lot was done during the World Cup, and there are more additions you'll have to do. For instance, there is no athletics track on the main Moses Mabhida Stadium.
Currently in the city's plans, and I think it's planned for 2016, is to install a track. So the track would have been installed regardless of whether we host the games or not. It's part of their long-term planning. As far as the village is concerned, the village in Kenobia is going to happen regardless of the games or not. That is part of the human settlements gap housing plan. That's going to take place regardless.
Are you saying that all aspects which were required for the games are already in the development plans of the city, regardless of whether or not South Africa hosts those games?
That's the difference between our games and what the Canada's budding. We looked at these games and said, how could we plug into our national development plan? As far as the stadiums are concerned, those upgrades were planned anyway. What we will have to do is spruce up some of the stadiums. And there's only one temporary facility we're putting up is for shooting. All the other facilities are there, it's running, and people are using it currently. This time around, we want to make sure that the youth of this country benefits from the bid.
That was Mark Alexander, the 2022 Durban Commonwealth Games Bid Committee Chairman, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, Tunisia's Esperance begin their title defense at the Africa Men's Club Volleyball Championships in Sousse, Tunisia, today, Thursday. The tournament winners will represent Africa at the World Men's Volleyball Club Championships in Brazil in May. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Lesotho's leading opposition parties has formed a coalition government after a snap election gave no group an outright majority. That's it for this Thursday, March 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.